Already, you know that. We've lost most of them already. Now, as I say, we've got a federal election coming up. You listen to these politicians. You listen to their ads and their speeches and what have you, if you can stand it, I can't, really. What are they saying? What are they talking about? They're talking about what? Their schools have to install litter boxes for kids who identify as furries and refuse to use the bathroom. That's the kind of thing they talk about. Nobody's talking about our future in space. They're talking about we gotta burn more gas or drill for more gas and liquefy it and export it so somebody else can burn it. Because that's how we eliminate the use of fossil fuels, is with gas. And you look around the world, and it's the same everywhere. You've got your congresses and your parliaments and your presidents and your prime ministers and your outright dictators. And what do they want to do? They want to go blow some more people up over there somewhere. Mobilize the military. Spend billions of dollars blowing stuff up that you'll then have to spend billions of dollars rebuilding. You know, what do they do? They go send billions of dollars to the people who they don't like very much. No, you know, Europe is still sending more money to the Russians every week for fuel than they're sending to Ukraine in support, and they're talking about, well, we're going to come up with a way to cap the price that we pay the Russians for fuel. And it's like, you think they'll keep selling it to you, do you? But this is what these politicians, you know, politicians and congresses and parliaments and presidents and dictators, not one of them has a bit of vision. They're all a bunch of dirt suckers. Well, you know, I look at the world. And I look at 50 years without a man walking on the moon. I look at 50 years in which we haven't gotten orbital industries. We haven't gotten mining colonies on the moon. We haven't gotten solar power satellites. Right? We haven't got any of that, have we? We've got more arms built up. Yay! We've got controversies over abortion. What the hell kind of political issue is that? Over gender. What the hell kind of political issue is that? Over immigration. I have some things to say about that, too. You've heard some of them, I think. But what about the future of humanity? What, even, in America, about the future of America? You know, the people saying, make America great again. Well, what was the greatest moment in America? Maybe when Americans walked on the moon, right? That was something the whole human race could be proud of. And we didn't just send men to the moon, we also sent them to the Senate. You know, Harrison Schmitt is an example. He was senator from New Mexico for a few years. John Glenn was a senator. I think Mark Kelly is the only senator now who has been an astronaut. I think he's the only person in the whole Congress who has been an astronaut. We could use some more of those, I think. You know, John Glenn almost ran for president in 1984. He was seeking the Democratic nomination, but his Meniere's disease recurred. That would have been a thing to be proud of, to have a spaceman president, and maybe it would have given us a little more perspective as to what's really important and what our politicians ought to be spending their time on. As it is, they're all a bunch of dirt suckers, and dirt sucker capitalists haven't done much better, have they? They continue to fund, you know, to stir up conflict and then profiteer off of it. They continue to find new ways of taking money for old rope. I read in the Wall Street Journal today, it's the most heartening thing I've read for a while in the Wall Street Journal, that Elon Musk's Twitter deal has tied up all the capital that's available, all the liquid capital available for mergers and acquisitions. There's not going to be any more mergers and acquisitions for some time because the banks can't finance them. And I said, well, if he's done one good thing, that's it. You know, but it's all dirt sucker politicians and dirt sucker capitalists and the dirt suckers who elected those politicians. And they just keep going along their dead-end path and dragging the rest of us with them. It would serve them right if Elon Musk sets up his slave colony on Mars, indentured servitude. Right? Oh yeah, borrow the money here on Earth and then you'll work it off when you get to Mars. We know how that one goes. That's an old song. It would serve them right if Bezos and Musk start fighting each other in space, slinging comets and asteroids around, and oopsie whoopsie, a couple of them hit the Earth, well, the collateral damage, you know. It'll, you know, I'm sure the Lloyd's insurance will pay for it or something. You know, are we covered for that? Do we have a comprehensive policy? Does it cover collision? Serve them right. Well, if you don't want that scenario, then support me. That's all I'm saying. Right? We have the chance now. We have the chance to exceed the limitations imposed by the Earth. We have the chance to exceed the limitations imposed by the political and economic systems that do as much to chain us to this planet as gravity does. I've explained my vision, right? I've explained, I hope, the idea that what we have to do is get people out there. I know last time I talked a lot about the far future, right? About the far future when we have thousands upon thousands of planetary and free space habitats where people can live according to their own lights and not interfere with each other and maybe, just maybe, come up with some ways to fix some of the problems that continue to dog us. People say, oh, we shouldn't leave the Earth until we've fixed all the problems we have down here. Well, how are we going to do it? As I've sometimes said, you can open a box with a crowbar that's inside it, but only if you're willing to shake real hard. No, I think that that diversity to come is definitely something that holds a great deal of promise for humanity, but of course it isn't here yet. This brings me back for a moment to talking about what I've been talking about a little bit here and there in the last couple of weeks particularly. Immigration and emigration and the implications of that. A Canadian friend of mine refers to Canada as a vampire state. He says, you know, the Canadian economy depends to a great deal on siphoning off talented and capable and ambitious people from other countries, including the United States, which used to be better about it than it is now. You know, as a matter of fact, apparently the Canadian Consulate General in San Francisco put up some billboards that said, H-1B problems? Come see us. Because if you can't get permission to remain in the USA and work after you've gotten your advanced degree from a U.S. university, well, guess what our neighbors to the north would like to talk to you? They are not wary at all of admitting high-skilled immigrants. My Canadian friend says he thinks that the problem that people in the U.S. have with that, the reasons why we don't just staple a green card to the back of every master's or Ph.D. diploma in the sciences and technical fields, he says he thinks it's because there are people who are very resistant to the idea of allowing in an immigrant who had become a white person's boss. Well, meh! You know, there are people. We had that horrible incident up in Buffalo, New York, where a guy decided to go and shoot a bunch of black folks because he said that white people in America are being replaced. Well, firstly, they're not being replaced with black folks. It's a cruel thing to say, but we stopped importing them about 150 years ago, if you notice. So exactly how you're going to be replaced by somebody who's already here, I'm not interested in knowing. All right, you've got some kind of bee in your bonnet. And apparently a lot more people believe that than are willing to go out and shoot up supermarkets. It's a major talking point for one of our political parties, a bunch of dirt suckers as they are. Well, white replacement. My father works in the sciences. He is an engineer in a fairly specialized field. He says, white replacement? Bring it on! He says there's nobody working in his lab other than him who was born in America and is what you call white. If they were born in America, their parents were born in India or Korea or someplace else. He says, all right, fine. If white people born in America don't want to learn the skills and take the jobs that make the world run, well, maybe they should be replaced by somebody who's not completely incompetent. How do you like them apples? White replacement, my eye. Anyhow, this vampire state phenomenon has consequences for policy in Canada. Americans have a tendency to regard Canada as suspiciously liberal. Now, part of that is just because Canada is cold, and in cold countries, people huddle together for warmth. Cold countries are typically far less suspicious of what people in the U.S. call socialism. You even see this in England versus Scotland. But the other thing is, again, Canada is a vampire state. Canada thrives by bringing in ambitious people, capable people, who aren't getting by where they are. And maybe that's because their sexuality or gender or way of expressing themselves is different from the majority, and they come from a country such as Iran, where that's not exactly something that is welcomed. Or, indeed, maybe they just come from Iran and they don't like being told you can't have loud parties. Right. Maybe they come from Iran and they don't like being told you can't have pork. It's hilarious how much Iranians in general love pork. Pork dealers are at least as ubiquitous as drug dealers in Iran. You know, canned hams from places like the United States, right, are being passed around, you know, in back alley deals in Tehran as we speak. And it's the middle of the night in Tehran as we speak. Anyhow, that's my, that's a consequence of the Canadian way of doing things, is that their social policies, you know, economically and socially, they thrive more the more accepting they are of different sorts of people and different viewpoints, and the more support that they provide for people who have had to leave their place of origin and come to a new place where they don't have the support structures that they had in the old place. And I think that probably, right, I think that probably has some strong implications for what space settlements and space settlers are going to be like, as I say, in the first few generations. Because again, in the long term, it's a different thing. In the long term, where you have those thousands of ultimately millions of habitats, individual habitats, each one a closed ecosystem, each one capable of minding its own business to some degree. But in the beginning, it's going to be different. In the beginning, your lunar settlements, as I say, that's where I see starting. That's what I see as most feasible in terms of getting there, you know, and that's what I see as most useful in terms of moving on from there. Your lunar settlements and your first few orbital settlements and so on are going to have a very welcoming policy toward people who have what I would call non-significant differences. And the thing is, those communities are going to be very small to begin with. And so there are people you just can't have. Anybody who basically is so obnoxious that they make everyone around them want to murder them is not going to last long. And I think people miss that about the moon as a harsh mistress, right? People look at the moon as a harsh mistress at a surface level, the Heinlein story, and they think, oh, well, this is a libertarian fairy tale. And it's like, a lot of the stuff that Heinlein's main character, his viewpoint character, talks about is actually that they have a very cohesive society because people who weren't willing to be socially cohesive didn't survive. And yeah, it's brutal, but, you know, that's the implication of a space colony to which people are deported. Now, a space colony to which people arrive voluntarily, presumably they're going to be selected before they leave. And I don't care about any of the so-called, you know, libertarian space colonists, and I've hung around with a lot of them over the years, you have to understand. And I stopped going to ISDCs after the 2016 presidential election because I just didn't think I could take it anymore. But I may start going back one of these days, but I haven't in years. The thing is, before somebody sets out for a space settlement, they're going to have to be tested for two things, right? Maybe more than two things, but, you know, yeah, you have to have skills that the colony needs. But, you know, those can be developed. You have to have the ability to get along with people in the environment of the colony, which means probably you're going to spend some time in what's referred to as an analog settlement. And they have those, you know, it's been done up in Baffin Land, out in the Nevada desert, even in the Chilean desert. Places which have habitats that simulate the space settlement habitat and so on. So you can figure out how you actually work under those conditions, how you actually live under those conditions. Well, I suspect that when we really are getting into the true phase of space settlement, there will be lots more of those, because you'll have to spend 6 weeks with at least some of the people that you're going to be spending your time with from then on to make sure you don't all strangle each other. Right, so obnoxious proselytizers, right, people with some really obnoxious religion, in which I include obnoxious atheist proselytizers, who are often the worst of the bunch because of their extreme intellectual snobbery, which is rarely warranted, right? Those kind of people are not going to be welcome in a space settlement. Anybody who really throws off the equilibrium. On the other hand, in terms of ethnic origins, well, we would like to have maximum of genetic diversity, to be perfectly honest. In terms of cultural origins, I mean, having people with different ideas about things, as long as it doesn't result in catastrophic friction, gives you the same kind of benefit that genetic diversity does. Namely, if there's a problem and one person with one background can't see a way around it, another person with another background might be able to see his way around it, right? So the problems of whom to select for a space settlement, those are difficult problems, but we don't have to face them the way that's been done in the past. You know, it's not like we're packing everybody onto the Mayflower and then sending them across the Atlantic, and when they arrive, they've got to, you know, farm or starve. Right. We can build up gradually, and that's what we sort of have to do. But yeah, the single biggest thing you have to demonstrate, aside from not making the people around you so angry they want to murder you, is that you're committed to space settlement. And so it's very likely, right, it's very likely that a big chunk of the first 100, the first 1,000, the first 100,000 people who go to live in space settlements are people who on Earth have contributed significantly towards the project of space settlement. In other words, for example, I mean, I'm not saying necessarily that you could buy your way in, but making big money contributions would be one way to show that, yes, I am doing everything that I can to make this happen, everything I can to make this a reality. Because, of course, it's a thing that you have to really seriously want, right? Anyhow, so I think I've covered that subject as much as I possibly can right now, although more capable writers have written on it than I can. You know, if you ever get hold of a volume entitled Interstellar Migration and the Human Experience, which was the report of a conference which was held at Los Alamos in the 80s. It's fascinating, and the story of the guy known as Afghan is worth a read just for the egads factor. But beyond that, I wanted to make a plea for creativity and play, and particularly in the natural sciences. You know, I was thinking the other day about Röntgen, right, the discoverer of X-rays, the guy who started the chain of events which led us into the atomic age. And the thing is, Röntgen was a professional scientist, right? He was a university lecturer in physics. But what was he doing when he discovered X-rays? Well, the answer is he was playing around with things that interested him. He didn't have a formal statement of work for what he was going to do with all those cathode ray tubes that he had basically asked around everybody experimenting with gas discharge tubes and cathode ray tubes. He asked them to send him their old equipment. And he was just playing around with it because it interested him. Everybody figured there were interesting things to be learned from studying gas discharges. Indeed, the mass of the electron was, well, the existence of the electron was one of the things that was revealed by that. But ultimately, Röntgen was essentially playing around with things that interested him. Gas discharge tubes, fluorescence, photography. These were things that were interesting to him, and as a university lecturer in physics at the time, when he wasn't lecturing, he was, and to a great extent, free to experiment, free to play around. You know, in today's publish or perish environment, teaching faculty and research faculty are often not necessarily the same people, right? You know, your classes are taught by TAs while the actual so-called professors are off, you know, doing research that's supported by outside grants. You know, places like University College London have got to the point that their faculty policies, are hiring and retention policies, are based on a table of who brings in the most outside money, which is about the worst kind of capitalism that I can possibly envision. I mean, in terms of the human mind, that's up there with slave trade. Good God. But Röntgen was free, more or less, to play around. And in the course of playing around, he discovered the X-rays. And when Becquerel heard about Röntgen's discovery, it stimulated him to do some research on fluorescence. And he had some fluorescent material lying around. What was it? It was uranium salts. Why did he have uranium salts lying around? Well, it turns out his father, who was also a scientist, had been interested in fluorescence and had been playing around with it at some point in the past and just put them away. And so Becquerel remembered that his father had done some of this. He got out the stuff his father had, and he used that because it was easier than going down to the shops and trying to find some new fluorescent materials. No, he used his uranium salts that his father had used a generation before. But Becquerel was fundamentally playing around when he discovered radioactivity. Even at Los Alamos, right, which was a scientific laboratory created for a hyper-specific purpose, even at Los Alamos, in the 1950s and 60s anyway, there was a policy to have more than enough people to handle everything they were saddled with, and when your day's work designing hydrogen bombs to annihilate the population of the Earth was over, right, you were allowed to do whatever you wanted with your time and with the laboratory facilities. As long as the work was proceeding on schedule, they didn't care how much time you spent, really, doing what was assigned to do. As long as what you got assigned to do was done by the time it was needed, you could spend a lot of your time playing around with computers, with laboratory equipment. Ultimately, our capacity for creativity and play is the most is fundamental to what we are as being human. And if we want to build a better world, we have to give highly intellectual people the ability to do that. Send those cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United 7.